Hey, next on the T Nation, welcome into part two of this week's show featuring PGA Master Professional John Hughes and journalist and author Ward Clayton. As you guys know, John is one of the few PGA Master Professionals in our game and a top 25 instructor with Golf Tips Magazine. Ward Clayton was a journalist for many, many years. He was a sports editor for the Augusta Chronicle, and he's written a couple of wonderful books. The most recent one that is out is The Legendary Caddies of Augusta National, Inside Stories from Golf's Greatest Stage. And it is a fantastic book. It's a page-turner, folks. The stories he tells and the way that he tells them are just off the charts fantastic. So sit back, relax, let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next hour or so. Before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants.
Every January, PGA Tour Superstore pros meet every manufacturer, learn about the latest equipment, log thousands of hours of training, and together hit over 100,000 balls, all so they can get you the perfect fit.
Now back in Next on the Tee with me is one of the top instructors in our game, and that is John Hughes. Let me remind you about John's background. He earned his business degree at Appalachian State. He's been teaching the game for almost 30 years. He's worked with everyone from beginners all the way up to tour pros. John is one of the very few PGA Master Professionals and a top 25 instructor with Golf Tips Magazine. In 2013, he won the Horton Smith Award for his dedication to education for all golfers. He was named the 2023 North Florida PGA Section Teacher of the Year. The Golf Range Association of America named him a top 100 Growth of the Game instructor, and he is the honorary president of the North Florida PGA Section. I had the privilege of meeting John in person the last couple of years down at the PGA Merchandise Show, and I couldn't be more excited. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, John, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Chris. How about yourself? It was interesting to hear Jim and his take on being grateful about a lot of things, especially this time of year. A wonderful individual.
Yes, he is. John, over the last few years, you've taken up a summer residency up there at Macklemore. You've seen firsthand the tremendous growth of that property. The new Cloudland Hotel just had its grand opening a couple weeks ago. The second course that our friends Bill Bergen and Reese Jones called The Keep, it is scheduled to be open a little bit later on this year. Talk about what you've seen up there and the growth of that property.
It is amazing to watch, amazing to experience. The first time I ever stepped foot on property was almost 2 years ago for a brief 10-day stay where I brought some clients up and they loved it. My wife loved it. I loved it. And had to find a way to stay up here one way or the other. And our good friend Charlie Reimers made that happen. Beginning May 1, I'm now the director of instruction seasonally here at Macklemore, a wonderful opportunity to help the growth and continue it on its fast pace to being one of the best, if not the best, private resort in the country. It's just amazing to watch. The people up here are fantastic to work with and for, and it should be a really exciting 2024 for us all.
Let's take that a little bit further, because I know you're going to have your golf schools up there through the summer and early part of the fall. Talk about your academy and what you have to offer to folks who will come up there to join you, or if they go with you back down in Orlando, because you also spend a little bit of time there at Champions Gate, predominantly up there at Macklemore. Talk about your golf academy and what you offer to folks when they come up there to take part of your golf school.
Well, we're working through a lot of that right now. I can start with the general public, the traditional vacation golf schools, whether it's one-to-one, two-to-one, or a group. We've got several group programs scheduled throughout the time I'm here, whether I'm coaching it or someone on staff is coaching those, hoping to get some events surrounding their singer-songwriter series done as well. Currently working on some what I'm going to call resort programming, some traditional things that you'd see at a great golf resort like Macklemore. Should have that posted here shortly. And of course, there's a membership here. They're very active, and we're trying to come up with some programs that not only they can be exclusively part of, but as spots are available, we can offer to the general public and have them feel like they're a member for a day as well.
John, when people come out to those instructional camps, when you first start to meet with them in the introduction in the early part of that, what that camp is, what do people tell you most often is the problem with their game?
One word, consistency, but I wish they really understood what it meant. They come to us much more consistent than they realize, and because it's all new to them after two, three, however many days they're here, they're probably a little bit more inconsistent when it comes to their skills. What I see and what I really harp on with everybody is, what are you doing consistently before you make a swing? And that's typically what's inconsistent. The way people are looking at social media and videos and all the traditional media outlets for golf, we're customized, we're culturalized, I should say, to be thinking about your swing. But what you have to remember is you're only going to swing the way you're set up. And when that is very inconsistent, that leads to your inconsistency. So once they embrace that ideal and once they take it and run with it, normally they can see some improvement right away. The real key after that is sustainability, whether they're doing something virtual with me or the other staff members or coming back for follow-ups. The bottom line, if you want to be consistent, make sure you're working on how you're setting yourself up, how you're making decisions to do that. It's all about consistently setting up and making a decision.
So, John, you send out a wonderful newsletter to your email subscribers with some great lessons and tips. And we talk a lot about the power of positivity on this show. And in one of your newsletters last month, you talked about being more positive about your game and being positive about what your goals are. Talk about why that's important.
That is just super important. There's so many people that dig holes for themselves with their negativity and what they can't do, and what you forget about is your brain is told to do things, not necessarily not to do things. And a great example to the general golfing public is, when was the last time you told yourself, don't hit it in the water with a forced carry, and you ended up doing it? The more positive you're thinking, the more due directive your intentions are, the better off you are just long-term, not only with golf, but with everything in life. And when I have somebody who's labeling things negatively, the first order of business is, let's get them thinking about what they can do and what they do well and build upon that. You know, that's a basic structure of human life. And when you put it to use with golf, it's a hard game. All we're trying to do is simplify it. And by making it a little bit more positive, that in itself is simplification, because when you're positive, you're thinking about smaller things. You're not thinking about complicated things. You're thinking about what's in front of you right now and what you're appreciative of right now and how to use what your strengths are and not necessarily dwell on weaknesses. It's super, super important and probably something that keeps me in business a long time as well as some of my friends.
We do tend to see all of the trouble out on the golf course, and we start to say to ourselves, well, boy, there's a pond over there. I hope I don't hit it in the pond, or out of bounds right, and trees on the left. And we start to think about all the things we don't want the golf ball to do instead of the one thing we do want it to do. How do you go about changing our perspective or our view so we stop focusing on the thing we don't want to have happen and really focus on what we do want to have happen?
Well, two things. Are you scouting the course well enough? Do you know your own golf course? I was very, very fortunate early in my career to be an assistant golf professional at a private facility in Greenville, South Carolina, where four different golf course architects were members. And they would sit down once a quarter, once every 4 months, and have lunch. And occasionally they'd invite me into lunch and I just picked their brain. It was an amazing education to understand and listen to four really good golf course architects. And what I learned from that was looking at the course backwards. When you look from the tee box to the green, you're supposed to be invoked with fear. You're supposed to see things that you want to avoid. And it's part of being a great golf course architect. That same information Bill Bergen and Reese Jones has provided me over the past several years being associated with Macklemore and formerly of Falcons Fire. We've had some great discussions about that. If you can look forward and document, sort of like your eyes are a digital camera, what you see in front of you, and then compare that to what you see looking from the green backwards, what disappears from that first photo, you should never, ever be concerned about. It's not part of the strategy to avoid. It's what you see looking backwards is what you should be targeting. So that leads to number two, what are your targets? What are you aiming for? I played with an older gentleman years ago at the Country Club of Charleston who happened to play a pro-am with Hogan, and Hogan had never played the course before. They started on number 12, a dogleg slightly down a hill, believe it or not, in Charleston to the right with some pine trees outlining the fairway. And Hogan asked where he should play his shot. He'd never played it. And the gentleman said to the five pine trees. Hogan turns around and says, which tree? And the guy was flabbergasted. So he said the middle one. And Hogan retorted, where on that middle tree? I mean, that's how focused the greats of the world are on small targets. Aim small, miss small. And it's a very simple lesson for all golfers to understand. But you have to understand where those targets are and understanding the golf course that you're playing and the features that truly are in play and picking targets that don't necessarily avoid them so much as the targets you're going to hit just makes the game that much more manageable and yourself more manageable in turn.
John, as I expressed to you over email, one of my goals this year is to make more putts in the 4 to 6 foot range. I know those are the ones that I should make, so I tend to get stressed out standing over top of them because I should make it, and I put that pressure on myself. And then I start to think, well, what happens if I don't make it? And everything sort of goes south from there. In your February newsletter, you talked about how to own putts inside of 5 feet. So what are some of the things I and we should be able to do with those kind of putts and of that length so that we're making the vast majority of them?
First and foremost is avoid them. That's you got to avoid those if you've got the yips with them. The real key with that, most 4 and 5 and 6 footers, particularly when you hit a green regulation, can lead to a 3-putt. And that's what I mean by avoiding them. Are you practicing the distances that you typically have when you hit a green? If you're 25 feet away and you're never practicing a 25 footer, then I encourage you to do that because that's what's going to allow you to be 2 and 3 feet away and have that tap in. But when faced with that 4 and 5 footer, are you practicing those from all angles? Number one. Number two, is the face of your putter aimed in the direction that the ball needs to start on? And do you control your distance well enough to reach the apex of that break to allow the ball to gently fall in the hole? So many times I see people ram these things in. When you really hit a pace with a lot of pace, when you hit a putt with a lot of pace, it actually makes the hole smaller. So you run the risk of, if you can't hit a straight putt to begin with and you're trying to ram it in the back of the cup from 5 feet, you could have another 5-footer coming back. I think you've got to control your distances first and eliminate them, get the tap-ins going first, and then gradually move backwards 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet around the world drill. I've done some videos about that drill. It's a fantastic drill to work under pressure, not just to hit them consistently over and over and over again, but work yourself around the hole and put some pressure on yourself that you're going to make 8 out of 8 or 6 out of 6 or 10 out of 10 before I move backwards. The real key is practicing these putts under pressure, and that's a fantastic drill to do so. But realize all putts are straight, and it requires that your face is aimed to where you want the ball to start, regardless of whether it's a 4-footer or a 40-footer. If you take all that into consideration, allow yourself some patience, hear the ball go in the hole, not so anxious to look up for it. You can make more of those and significantly reduce your score immediately. People just don't realize the math it can be.
John, one of the toughest chip shots that we face is when the ball is on hard pan grass, whether it's tightly mowed or an area where there just isn't any grass at all. We tend to either chunk that shot or scull it across the green. What are some keys to hitting that shot successfully?
Yeah, that's one of the videos I've recently put out. Thanks for asking the question, Chris. It's really simple. You've got to have the club contact the ball on the ground simultaneously, and that takes a really good setup position, typically ball middle to slightly back of middle in your stance. You're looking to find the correct bounce, not necessarily the correct loft of the club. Bounce is significant. Too much bounce is going to make the club bounce into the ball and scull it. In turn, you may start flipping it. You may start trying to lift the ball in the air, and that's not going to be good as well. The other thing to remember is coming in steep with that type of shot doesn't necessarily make for good ball club contact. You want to try to just do what you normally do and have the ball in a position where the club meets the ball at the same time it hits the ground, and trust that how much you brought the club back is going to determine how far that ball goes forward. The worst thing you can do is bring it all the way back behind you and try to slow it down on the way there. You're best off just accelerating. That acceleration will create spin more so off a hard pan lie than it would a fluffy lie, believe it or not. And it's a matter of going out and practicing from absolutely bare spots to divots to cement cart paths. It doesn't really matter what that hard pan is. If you go out and try it a couple of times, experiment with your setup, a lot of things can happen positively when you're faced with that shot in the future.
You do such a great job publishing new video tips on your YouTube channel, which everyone should go out and subscribe to. You can go on YouTube at youtube.com/@JohnHughesGolf. Another thing that plagues a lot of us are first tee jitters. How can we overcome those?
It's about being calm and realizing that if you're nervous, you care. You're not nervous because you don't care. You actually do care, but you may be caring too much. A really quick story with this. There was a long time ago, we had one person come to a golf school, a one-to-one golf school that I did. That was his biggest problem, was going to the member guest and the club championship. And his club actually had a gallery around the first hole. And every year he'd end up hitting somebody in that gallery. So working on tee shots and what have you from a physical skill standpoint of view, we got that accomplished. And we went out to play the golf course for 9 holes of on course one day. And little did he know that we gathered everybody in the club, everybody in the restaurant, the maintenance staff, the outside staff, and we put a throng of people around the first hole, and immediately the jitters were there again. We just had to work through what his routine was. The breathing mechanism, the breathing techniques that help calm your nerves, reoxygenize your body, being able to pick that one target that your eyes migrate to and can stay focused upon, and then having a cadence in your mind that just makes you feel relaxed. For me, years ago, it was the theme song of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that kept me calm. I could hum it to myself, and if I was too nervous, I could feel the humming or the noise in my head getting very high-pitched and tight, and that was a red flag. I needed to step backwards and start it all over again. These are just some things that you can do to get over the first tee jitters, but realize that everybody on that tee has them. You're not on that cruise ship all by yourself. Find a routine that just allows you to be you and takes all the pressure off the shot, because it's just another tee shot. When you can go about your business on the first tee, realizing this is just the first of what's going to be a great, fun day on the golf course, it should be a lot easier to deal with those jitters.
John, you know I'm a huge Jack Nicklaus fan, and one thing that he used to do when he set up on the tee was hover his driver or his 3-wood off the ground prior to his backswing. Talk about the advantage of doing that.
Yeah, that's been a good study the past few years by a lot of people, realizing that hovering the club can actually take tension out of your swing. If you're somebody who presses the club in the ground for any reason, you're creating some pressure, particularly hand tension and grip pressure. And what the studies have found is that once you get used to the fact that you are hovering the golf club, it keeps you in continuous motion. You become more reactive. The tension in your hands, your upper body tends to release itself, and it doesn't dissipate completely, but it allows you to move freer. And it does create more speed, club head speed, where it counts at impact. When you're pressing that club in the ground, that's a sure sign of tension. You're probably getting tense from the elbows up because of it. Really, really good idea to hover. And it doesn't have to stay still hovering. I would make the recommendation that a hover should be even the smallest of motions just to keep you into continuous motion. It's a very, very good pre-shot routine to get into that should help you long term, not only overcome the jitters, but possibly eliminate some injury as well.
John, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can they get signed up for one of your golf schools? How can they go online and find you both on your website, on YouTube, and then, of course, on social media as well?
Well, I had a great mentor years ago who said, make it easy for people to find you. So you just add a hashtag, an ampersand, anything like that to find me on social media, John Hughes Golf. JohnHughesGolf.com is the website. And if you're interested in seeing me or one of my staff here at Macklemore, go to MacklemoreGolfSchool.com. All the information is there for you to come see us this summer at Macklemore. Chris, really appreciate the opportunity. Again, being on, it's wonderful. You've been a big help, and look forward to having more of these conversations in the future.
Same here, John. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show. I hope the window makes sense for when we're coming up to Macklemore here in about a month or so. Hopefully I catch you before you have to head out back down to Orlando. Maybe we get lucky and get a couple of minutes with you, because you're one of the best there is, my friend. And I can't thank you enough for all you've meant to me in this show.
Thank you. I'll find the time to see you.
All right. Take care, John. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
See you, John. That is the great John Hughes, folks. Again, John Hughes Golf is where you can find him online and on social media. MacklemoreGolfSchool.com. Look, if you're going to go out and you're going to go to a golf school this year, do yourself a favor, not only because Macklemore is a great facility that John talked about early on, and it's on the Cloudland Hotel that just had its grand opening, looks absolutely spectacular. So you're going to be in a great setting. But John is one of the great teachers. There's a reason why he's in the top 25. There's a reason why he's a PGA Master Professional, which very few people are. So you're going to get the very best. You're going to have the best location, a great practice facility, and the top teacher that you're going to have out there anywhere. So do yourself a favor, package all that together and go see John this summer up at Macklemore. If you can't see him there, then you can send videos to him. He also does video lessons as well, so you can find him and send your videos to him, whether it's on V1 or just directly to him. So John is a wonderful human being. It's been great to get to know him over the last few years, and then it was an honor to get to spend time with him at the PGA Merchandise Show the last couple of years. So looking forward to getting him back on the show again. We'll try again here over the next couple of months. I'd love to make John one of the regulars that you get to see. Okay, coming up in the final segment of this week's show is going to be Ward Clayton. Ward is a wonderful journalist and an author. Before I bring him into the show, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's SQAIRZ.com.
Frustrated with your golf game? Imagine playing with total confidence. Join me, LPGA Pro and golf mindset expert, Debbie O'Connell, for my Conquer Your Golf Mind Challenge. Bill cuts 6 strokes, and Lori is club champion. What's your goal? Click the link or text NEXT to 727-339-0106. Use code NEXT for $20 off. Your tee time for transformation is now. Will you take the shot?
All right, now making his next on the tee debut with me is Ward Clayton. Let me give you some background on Ward. He earned his degree in journalism at the University of North Carolina. He's been a sports writer for publications like the Durham Morning Herald. He's been the sports editor for the Augusta Chronicle and director of editorial services for the PGA Tour. For the last 13 and a half years, he's been an editorial director for Augusta National and their digital presence on Masters.com. In 2004, he wrote a book titled Men on the Bag, The Caddies of Augusta National. He's recently come out with an updated version of that book, which is titled The Legendary Caddies of Augusta National, Inside Stories from Golf's Greatest Stage. And I couldn't be more excited. I get to have him with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Ward, thanks for coming on the show.
Chris, thanks for having me. I hope everything's going all right with you.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you. So, Ward, before we get into your books, I want to go back to the beginning for you. I want to talk about what it was like for you growing up in Durham, North Carolina, down the street from Hillendale Golf Course, which is a Donald Ross and Perry Maxwell design and one of the most affordable places to go play anywhere in the country right now. Talk about what it was like for you growing up there.
Chris, we're all a product of our environment. I grew up 6 blocks from Hillendale, which is a municipal golf course. And in the other direction, in 2 miles, was Cameron Indoor Stadium, where Duke University is, where they play basketball. I'm a Tar Heel. I went to school in Chapel Hill. But still, to this day, college basketball and golf are two of my favorite things to do. So, therefore, we're all products of our environment. And that pays tribute to that. Hillendale and college basketball will never go away from.
So you got to help me there because I'm a Carolina basketball fan as well. So how does a kid from Durham, North Carolina, in the heart of Duke University, end up going to Chapel Hill?
Chris, Durham is 8 miles from Chapel Hill. So there are probably more UNC fans in Durham than there are Duke fans just by sheer numbers. Now, UNC's got 20-some thousand students. Duke's got maybe 7,000 or 8,000. Duke's private, UNC's public. So you're right in the heart of North Carolina. So therefore, you can imagine that a lot of folks are Tar Heels living in Durham. There's some Dukies around, but there's probably more Carolina fans than there are anybody.
About a dozen years or so, Ward, you worked for a company called Golf Zone. It was the world's largest golf simulator company. They are a South Korean organization, and you helped get them over here and get traction in the U.S. Talk about who they are and the work you did there.
Golf Zone is the, I guess it's pretty easy to do a parallel here. It's the Cadillac of golf simulators. It's probably the most expensive simulator, but it's the most, it gives you the most data. Most realistic. They even have the moving swing plate that allows you to have hanging lies. They even put these pieces in there that simulate hitting out of a bunker or hitting out of rough. So I think it's the most realistic that you can get. It's the most expensive, but then again, if you're looking for a realistic way to play indoor golf, then I think Golf Zone is probably the one you want to use. And a lot of LPGA players who are from South Korea learned how to play golf on hitting balls on a simulator because particularly if they're from Seoul, there's not a lot of golf in Seoul. It's so crowded, and it's a long way to the suburbs to play on a real golf course. So they go to these little cafes, which are like Starbucks in the States. There's these little cafes on every corner where you can go in and have a drink and hit golf balls. And I think a lot of particularly the female golfers in South Korea started playing that way because it was not intimidating. They could go hit balls, and they also learned some of the basics of the golf swing so well, and that carried forward to their professional careers.
Around the same time, you started doing some contract work for Augusta National and their web presence. How'd you get started over with the folks there at the National?
Chris, I was a sports editor at the Augusta Chronicle from 91 until 2000. So that's where my knowledge of Augusta and all things the Masters came to being. And when I left the PGA Tour in 2010, I was in the communications department there. It was a natural to work with them every year during the Masters, especially on the digital side with Masters.com. So that was a pretty easy transition. And I'll toot my own horn a little bit. This year, the Masters, that was the 40th consecutive year I've been to the Masters. So it's quite an experience every spring to go to that place.
So you got to let me live a little vicariously through you, because I'm a huge fan of the Masters and Augusta National. I'd been on property every year since 2001 until this year, but it's my favorite place on the planet. So what are some of the cool perks that you got to be a part of during all the time that you were doing work for Augusta National? How many times you played the course?
I played the course 10 times, but all of them occurred when I was in Augusta at the Chronicle. That was even more of a perk. When you're in the local media, at least it used to be this way. Before, a lot of folks may not know that Augusta National is only open from October until May. It's closed in the summer. It's a winter golf course. But they invited the local media to come play the course in late May. And so we had the opportunity to, we could roll in there early in the morning and go play the par three course and then play the regular golf course, you know, a week before it closed. So that was a real cool experience. As far as with Masters.com, I think it's just been able to see sort of behind the scenes around the property and go in the clubhouse, go into some various buildings like the Jones Cabin and stuff like that, and sort of see some historic places. That's a cool experience and a perk unto itself.
So let's talk about the latest book, The Legendary Caddies of Augusta National, Inside Stories from Golf's Greatest Stage. Tell everybody, who is Stovepipe, Burnt Biscuit, Skillet, Skinny, Iron Man, and Marble Eye?
Everybody's got a nickname, Chris. I suspect that you probably had a nickname as a kid, even though you may not want to reveal it to your listeners. everybody's got a nickname, whether in golf or not. So a lot of these caddies got nicknames, and that's what intrigued me. That's what sort of bubbled to the surface for me. Was at the Augusta Chronicle, we were always telling these historic stories about the Masters, and occasionally we'd run into stories from the 40s, 50s, and 60s where a caddy was mentioned just by his nickname. That was all there was. And so I said, wow, this person's bound to have a story and a name behind his nickname. And so that started a whole process where in 1999, Vanessa Peterson Fox called our office at the Chronicle and reported that her father, Willie Peterson, who caddied for Jack Nicklaus for his first five Masters win, he had passed away in New York. And so that sort of started the process with me of trying to track down all these stories and all these caddies, see if these guys were still alive, how many friends, how many family members, things like that were alive, because they were such an essential part of Palmer and Nicklaus and Hogan winning the Masters that their story needed to be told too. So I thought that was an essential thing. So I did that in 2004 with a lot of their nicknames and their real names being revealed. Chris, that became a documentary in 2019 about caddying around the world called Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk, with Bill Murray as the narrator. And then the book was out of print in 2004, and there was a lot of stories to add on to it, a lot of detail that I had. And I'd also learned a lot of the barriers these guys had overcome just to get to their workplace. And so I figured it was due a vast update and addition, and that's what Legendary Caddies is, the book that's currently out there.
I want to talk about some of these caddies because the stories are fantastic. I don't want to give them all away because I want people to go out and buy the book and read these fantastic stories that you've put together. But you mentioned Willie Peterson. I'm a huge Jack Nicklaus fan. Talk about why Jack said he wouldn't trade Pete for $1 million.
Jack was famous not only at Augusta, but everywhere on not really relying on his caddy. Jack was one of the first guys, along with Dean Beeman, to start using a yardage book and stick it in his back pocket. He's one of the first guys to ever do that. And so Willie was a local caddy, but Willie also had a personality that was opposite of Jack when he played at Augusta. Jack was very reserved, very methodical when he played. Willie was the kind of guy that would take a towel off the golf bag and twirl it over his head like somebody hit a home run, or talk to the gallery, or really jump up and down when Nicklaus made a long putt, or even watch Nicklaus hit balls before a round and walk by the caddy shack on the way to the first tee and bet everybody in the caddy shack that Jack was going to shoot 65 or better, which was not a real smart bet, but that was Willie's personality. He was the kind of person that kept Jack loose, kept him in the game, that kind of stuff. So he was very much the psychological edge that Jack needed. So Willie, as I said earlier, you know, in 1999, he passed away, but he was definitely the epitome of somebody that's going to get somebody motivated, make them laugh, things like that going around. I think a lot of caddies serve that purpose.
Willie Frank Petit, otherwise known as Cemetery, was President Eisenhower's caddy. Talk about what his original nickname was and how he got from his original nickname to what Ike changed it to.
Willie Petit was a drummer in a jazz band in downtown Augusta. So he would caddy during the day, and at night he'd go play in the jazz band. His original nickname was Dead Man. President Eisenhower thought that was a little too blunt, so he changed the name to Cemetery. The way he got his nickname is pretty humorous unto itself. He was playing one night at his jazz band, and months before, he had befriended this young lady, and she wanted to get really serious with him, and he didn't care to do that, so he broke off the relationship. Well, she got some of her friends one night to meet her down at the club where he's playing. And when he came out back at about 1 o'clock in the morning, they jumped him with knives and cut him up and injured him pretty badly. An ambulance took him to the local hospital. The doctors working on him and evidently gave him too much ether. And they thought he had passed away and sent him to the morgue. And lo and behold, he's in the morgue, and the mortician's doing his work late at night, early in the morning, and Cemetery wakes up and scares the mortician half to death. The story gets out, and lo and behold, he gets the nickname Dead Man and then Cemetery. So he never lived that down, I guess you could say. It's a turn of phrase there. So he was quite the character, much like Willie Peterson.
Gene Sarazen's caddy was nicknamed Stovepipe. Talk about how he got that nickname.
When Sarazen won the Masters, the caddies did not have the patented jumpsuits. They dressed very much like somebody who was a farmer or just the usual dress of the day. They may have had a number pinned on their back so that fans could identify who the player and caddy was, but that was inexact. It wasn't as much of a situation then. Stovepipe wore a hat much like Abraham Lincoln made famous, one of these tall, thin hats that looked like a stovepipe. And that's how he got the nickname, just by wearing that hat. There's one picture in Gene Sarazen's book, 30 Years of Championship Golf, and it's very grainy, and it shows Sarazen, who's all of 5'5", standing beside Stovepipe. Stovepipe is maybe 6'1", and he's wearing this hat, and it looks like he's about 6'4". So he's towering over Gene Sarazen. But supposedly, when Sarazen was going to go for the green in two on 15 that year, 1935, Stovepipe was also a minister, and he discouraged him from going for the green. He wanted to try to protect his place in the field and make as much money as possible. He didn't want him to make bogey in the hole, and lo and behold, he made double eagle and then went on to win the tournament. So Stovepipe was just simply because that's the hat that the guy wore.
Carl Jackson is a guy we all know as Ben Crenshaw's longtime caddy. His nickname was Skillet because he played baseball there in the city of Augusta. He was a pitcher. Said he couldn't break an egg when he threw it. He just threw junk. I think that's a great story.
Yeah, Carl is probably the shining example of how these caddies could come from very difficult circumstances into becoming quite the person. Carl's now 77 years old. He had to quit school at age 12 to go caddy because he had a number of brothers and sisters and he needed to go make some money to support the family. And lo and behold, he befriended Crenshaw. He befriended Jack Stevens, who was one of the richest men in the country and also became the chairman of Augusta National. Carl worked in his business in Arkansas for decades, had six children, all of them who earned college degrees when Carl dropped out when he was age 12. So Carl, and there's a documentary which debuted privately during Masters Week called Rise Above, which is the Carl Jackson story, which was very honest. It was very emotional, telling the story of where Carl came from and how he got to the point where he is now, which was all attributes to Carl for doing what he did, and all the praise can go. As a matter of fact, Chris, Bones McKay, who caddied for Mickelson and used to caddy for Justin Thomas, calls a caddy facility at Augusta. He said it ought to be called the Carl Jackson House, just because of the legacy that Carl has.
That's fantastic. You mentioned that they didn't always wear the white jumpsuit that we see them wear nowadays. Talk about where that came from.
Chris, there's a uniform shop in downtown Augusta called International Uniform. And it's run by a gentleman named Fred Daitch, D-A-I-T-C-H. And Fred's family immigrated to the United States 100 years before, Jewish family, and settled in Augusta. And his grandfather and his father used to make uniforms and had jeans and all these kind of things in downtown Augusta. And they made raincoats for the Masters in the 40s and into the 50s. And they would send a trailer full of raincoats that was sealed to Augusta National, hoping that it was going to rain. And the reason they hoped it was going to rain, that if Augusta National broke the seal on that trailer and got out a raincoat, they had to buy the entire trailer full of raincoats. So Fred's family was hoping it rained in the morning and then cleared up in the afternoon because they were going to make a big buck. And lo and behold, he started making the caddy suit, and that took off. And not only did the caddy suit take off for him, but if you go to his business in downtown Augusta, they have all these caddy bibs for all these clubs around the country that have caddy programs. They don't supply the uniforms for the Augusta National any longer, but they have developed this burgeoning business, which is really quite spectacular. And I think that the caddy suits are the parallel to the green jacket. You know, the player gets the green jacket, the caddy gets the white jumpsuit, which Carl Jackson calls the tuxedo of caddy uniforms. But the cool thing to me, Chris, is the green jacket goes away with the champion. Like Scottie Scheffler has got his green jacket at home now. He's got to bring it back next year. Ted Scott can keep that jumpsuit, which he orders from Augusta National forever. He doesn't have to bring it back.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he can. He has to write a letter to the club, be formal about it, say, hey, and they'll get him one and ship it to him, and he can just keep it.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, Ward, the book is endlessly fascinating. Let our listeners know, how can they go out and get a copy of it and then follow all the great things that you're doing, whether they're doing it online or they're doing it on social media?
Chris, we're so programmed these days to ordering things to deliver to our front door. I'd encourage everybody to go to your local independent bookseller or other bookstores, but you can also go to Amazon or go to our publisher, which is Blair Pub. B is in boy, L-A-I-R, Pub, pub.pub.com. Sounds like somewhere you go have an adult beverage. So by all means, have an adult beverage, read the book, but you can order it that way and it'll come directly to you. And I'll tell you, Chris, one cool thing is this year, all the major championships, I live in Jacksonville, Florida. I could drive to all the majors. The Players was in March in Ponte Vedra Beach. The Masters in Augusta in April. The PGA Championship this week in Louisville, Kentucky. And then come June, the U.S. Opens at Pinehurst number 2. So if you live in the South, you could just get in your car and go to these events. I think it's a pretty unusual year for major championships. So that's got me pumped for the major championship golf this year.
I agree. Well, Ward, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come and be a part of the show. So much more to get into with you. I didn't want to give everything about the book away. I certainly want people to go out there and buy it and enjoy it for themselves. I hope you'll come back a little bit later on this summer and get into more of the detail and the stories that you shared, because like I say, it's endlessly fascinating.
By all means, we'll do it. I'll come back and I'll add that Southern accent to your show. That'd be awesome.
Indeed. Ward, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. Right. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, Chris. Take care.
You too. Thank you, Ward. That is Ward Clayton. Again, the book is called The Legendary Caddies of Augusta National, Inside Stories from Golf's Greatest Stage. I mean, you guys know what a huge fan of the Masters and Augusta National I am. As I said to my wife many times, when I die, it's her responsibility to get some of my ashes and put it there at Augusta National, because it's absolutely always been my favorite place on the planet. And then when you go back and you read these historical stories about these wonderful caddies, and to Ward's point, you get to learn, first of all, Stovepipe, Burnt Biscuit, Skillet, Skinny, Iron Man, Marble Eye, just a few of the caddies and their nicknames. But then you get to learn the stories behind how those nicknames came about and what their lives were like. And it is just, you know, I'm not the world's greatest reader, but when I picked up this book and started to read the stories behind it, it becomes a page turner. I mean, you can't put it down. That's how interesting these stories are, and what a great writer that Ward is, that he keeps you, turning these pages to learn a little bit more and to keep learning about the next guy and the next guy and the stories behind those things. It's just a wonderful book. I can't recommend it enough. I hope you enjoyed listening to him share some of these stories as much as I did. We'll try to get him on a little bit later on this year, talk about a little bit more, get into some more of his time out there at Augusta National. Thanks to Ward for joining me. He's fantastic. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. Want to send out my sincere thanks again to Adam Heisdew, Jim Gallagher Jr., John Hughes, and Ward Clayton for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are our resident director of instruction, Tom Patchery, will be back with us. Champions Tour Pro Clark Dennis will make a return appearance here on Next on the Tee. Excited to catch up with Clark. And our good friend and former PGA Tour Pro Tim Simpson will be here. Tim is such a delight in every aspect. Really looking forward to that conversation. And then we're going to round things out with high school golf coach and military veteran Tim Gastel. Tim has been a wonderful follow at Coach G out there on Twitter or X, whatever we call it. Go out there and follow him. What a wonderful guy he is. So really looking forward to having him as part of the show next week as well. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I hope you'll come back and be a part of it with us. Quick reminder for you, you can find the show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. But in particular, we're out there on the Pittsburgh Tribune review site. Just go to triblive.com and click on sports, and you're going to find right there on the homepage of the sports section the latest edition of the show available for you right there. And then click on sports and then podcast, and you're going to be able to find any one of our episodes from this year available for you there as well. You can also find the show available on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audioboom, Player.fm. Again, all over the net. Whatever you have for your favorite podcast site, we're probably on that one too. And as always, my thanks to the folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of the recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But as always, most of all, my sincere thanks go out to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I can't tell you how much I appreciate each and every one of you. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.